welcome to episode 145 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Nathan Smith
and Dylan Moore.
And in today's episode, we'll be looking at movies we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be kicking off our multiple month long series, Young Critics Watch Old Movies. Always a fun series. Very excited. We got a great list. We've talked about it the last few weeks. But this week, we're going to be starting it with 1928's The Crowd, the King Vidor film. But let's go ahead and get into movies that we saw this week. Nathan, let's lead off with you because you saw a pair of new releases.
Yeah, so I've seen a couple new movies that are new in theaters this week. First off, I guess I will talk about the kind of like big, wide, recent release. Alien Covenant, the latest film in the Alien franchise, directed by Ridley Scott, the sort of prequel to the first Alien movie, but also sequel to Prometheus from 2012. I also watched that movie for the first time this weekend. A lot of people really don't like that movie. It got pretty negative reviews when it came out, or at least like middling reviews. I actually thought that movie was okay. I mean, Ridley Scott, I'm not really fond of as a director. If you've been listening since our Blade Runner episode, you know that both Zach and I weren't crazy about that movie. And Ridley Scott, I feel like, has a tendency to just kind of like do this fake deep philosophy stuff that really just gets on my nerves. And there's a lot of that in Prometheus, but I don't know. It feels like a more personal movie, and I feel like I can detect more of him as a person in it, which is kind of one of my problems with a lot of his movies, is they just feel very cold and very inhuman and just kind of boring, honestly, just because they are so feel so distanced in not a good way. But Prometheus worked for me for the most part. Alien Covenant, I was kind of looking forward to. There are definitely things I liked about this movie, but for the most part, I thought it was pretty dull. It kind of recycles a lot of plot points from the original Alien movie. It follows this giant colonization mission that is going to a new planet. They have mapped it out. They've got 2,000 colonists. All the colonists are married. In the very beginning of the film, you see Michael Fassbender playing another android named Walter, not David from Prometheus, although David does show up and become very important to the movie. He's walking around the ship, taking care of everything, but there's some kind of like interspace, I don't know, whatever, accident, solar flare thing. A bunch of people die. James Franco, who is the ship's captain, dies. You only see his burnt corpse, and then you see him in a bunch of photographs in videos that look like outtakes from 127 Hours after his wife, played by Catherine Waterston, is kind of mourning him. And if you're going to put an actor in your movie, like tangentially for 5 minutes, don't pick James Franco, because like that's the most distracting possible choice. It's weird. I don't know. It really took me out of the movie within the first like 5 minutes. I kind of wonder if it wasn't just like a Danny McBride is in this movie. They're friends. Let's just put James Franco in it.
I can hear him being totally down and being like as a looming presence, right? It's like just like everybody have a photograph of me and I'm just like in the background. I can hear James Franco being down for that.
There's though a photograph that shows up later in the movie that basically casts him as Jesus in the Last Supper, which is really weird.
Oh, wow.
So once James Franco burns alive, Billy Crudup takes over as captain. He's this very faithful man, very religious, very nervous, very cautious. I kind of joked on Twitter that he basically seemed like Mike Pence because he kept talking about how because he is a man of faith, people persecute him and judge him. And also the ship's computer is named Mother, and so he keeps talking to Mother. So I actually thought Billy Crudup's character was kind of interesting, and I thought they were going to explore his like position as a man of faith, but they didn't really do that. The movie sort of very quickly becomes about Catherine Waterston. They find this strange Earth-like planet. They land on it very quickly, as happens in the Alien movies. Things go wrong. People get infected. taken over by these like new xenomorphs that are white and look like the alien from that movie Splice with Adrian Brody, if you guys remember that movie. And then they encounter the android played by Michael Fassbender from the first in this series, Prometheus, David, who has like taken over this weird castle where all there are all these corpses of the sexy Squidward aliens from Prometheus. And it's like, I don't know, there's some pretty bizarre and baffling scenes with Michael Fassbender and Michael Fassbender.
Okay.
Like Michael Fassbender teaching Michael Fassbender how to play the flute and is like, ooh, I'll do the fingering for you. And it's like, and then there's another.
It's weirdly sensual. Okay.
There is some like, there's literally a scene where Michael Fassbender kisses Michael Fassbender. So in that respect, the movie is worth seeing. But once you have the David character come in, it very quickly goes into the kind of like fake deep unnecessary philosophy stuff. Like there's literally a scene where David is looking out over the destruction on this planet and starts reciting Ozymandias, and it just could not be like more on the nose. It really just like did not work for me at all in that respect. And I really hate the idea that, like, you know, really Scott is interested in these questions of like, Where do we come from? The origin of man. And in these movies, in these two movies, Prometheus and Covenant now, he seems to really be mad at God. And he's just like, oh, God, why do you hate us? Why do you curse us with these things? And it's like,
oh, God.
I kind of like it in that respect that it's this like very angry, almost anti-faith movie. And that's just like very odd for a huge Hollywood blockbuster. But at the same time, I think the aliens and the xenomorphs, which are kind of minimized in this movie, unfortunately, I think they're best unexplained, and they're best as kind of like nature's dark id, you know, as this kind of like pure evolutionary fear of biology and fear of our own bodies. Having like a creator come in and explaining the origin, it kind of like points to a lot of problems, I think, just with franchise filmmaking in general, where it's like a movie comes out that's just like a straight up genre movie, like the first Alien movie. And then after this, it spawns this franchise, there's this need to like retcon everything and tie it into this larger mythology that didn't exist in the beginning. And it's like, sometimes that works, you know, but sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, well, I think that just kind of gets to my biggest issue with Ridley Scott is that, I've talked about this before, where it's, you know, all of his movies, or most of his movies, they have these, you know, various cuts, and he's always adding more, and, you know, you want to go Ridley, like your best movie, your most perfect movie is Alien, and that's just such a basic genre film that does all of that basic stuff so well. That's what it resonated with people, and I don't get that line of thinking that if we explain the xenomorphs and the aliens and we explain all of this stuff, it's gonna make all of that everything more rich. And I'm just like, no, it's not. Like that's. I don't know. I agree with you. I don't really understand that line of thinking when it comes to big blockbuster movies.
I agree to that point, and I wonder if some of that is because they're trying to find bigger cogs to cause more movies to occur, right? Like if they build a larger structure that kind of hints at other things, then it makes it easier to justify another movie as opposed to something that is self-contained. Yeah. Right. So
100%. So that's I mean, it's a money move.
So.
Yeah, it's a
And Ridley Scott said there's going to be like three more Alien prequels before they reach the first one, which just seems so stupid to me. And really makes me just exhausted. Even though I like the basic idea of Alien, I love the creature design. And there's a lot of kind of like kill scenes in this that are just really like blood spurting ooze that I was kind of into. But it's pretty dull. Although I will say Danny McBride is in this. Danny McBride, of course, is always great and makes every movie better than it is. And that's the best part of the movie for me is Danny McBride. Although it is super funny to hear Danny McBride say like sci-fi stuff like, we're turning the forward thrusters on, going to do a drop landing. And this just really straight, like serious voice. But he's also really funny in it too.
Yeah.
But also he's got some emotional moments. So anyways, Alien Covenant, if you're going to see it for Danny, see it for my boy, Danny McBride. Second new release I'll just touch on real quickly. I like this one a lot, but I kind of don't have a lot to say about it. The new film from Terrence Davies, A Quiet Passion. It's kind of the story of the life of the renowned American poet Emily Dickinson. It picks up with her as a young schoolgirl, very independent, very rebellious, and follows her kind of throughout the course of her life until her death. Emily Dickinson is played by Cynthia Nixon. You also have a really great performance by Keith Carradine in this movie. And I think this is a really profound and beautiful movie about the passing of time. It's really funny and witty, too. It's very well written. Every character has just like this wealth of great lines. Friend of the podcast and regular contributor Darren Hughes, after he saw this movie on Letterboxd, he said that this is like the one movie where he's wanted to go through the screenplay and like highlight and underline lines, which I felt the same way about this movie. I think it's kind of maybe reach it. It's obviously much darker and more dramatic than this movie, but I think it kind of scratches the same itch as Love and Friendship. You just have a lot of really great scenes of women being very witty. And obviously it's Terrence Davies, so it's very handsomely composed. There are these kind of, a few sort of dreamy, nighttime sequences that are just absolutely lovely. For me, the movie really came together early in the film. There's this moment where you see all these younger versions of Emily Dickinson and her family posing for photographs, and Davies starts to zoom in on them. And while he's zooming in, they like age into the older versions of themselves. And it's just absolutely chilling. And the whole movie, you're just kind of, you know, you're watching these people grow and, you're really seeing how they change, because in the beginning of the movie, Emily Dickinson is this absolutely like bright, fiercely independent person. And just because of kind of the difficulties that existed for her being a woman who wanted to write and who wanted to be published and be recognized for her work, you know, she kind of becomes a lot more difficult and a lot angrier and kind of bitter at the world. And you really see that evolution. And even though at the end of the movie it starts to get a little bit uncomfortable just how angry she is kind of at everyone around her, you really still, I think, kind of understand the character. You understand her and you understand why she kind of became that way and what led to that. And I think Cynthia Nixon does an absolutely fantastic job and kind of captures all of these points of a very rich and full person. So if A Quiet Passion is in your area, I definitely recommend seeing it. And real quick, I just want to, we'll not get into details. We'll not get into spoilers. Even though it's aired, you know, since it's on Showtime, a lot of people haven't seen it yet, but Twin Peaks, The Return, season 3, I've seen the first 2 episodes so far. And, let me tell you, it is amazing. It is crazy and wild and unbelievable to hear that theme song hit. I was really nervous going in, but you know, David Lynch is David Lynch. You know, he's a master artist, and the first 2 episodes are just like something to behold, like both really terrifying, but also really funny. The series is filmed really strangely. You can definitely tell this is kind of like the Lynch of Inland Empire and Lost Highway, who doesn't really care anymore what you think. The series is like shot kind of brightly lit, kind of has like a, you know, very digital soap opera-y, like vaguely porny kind of look to it. But I think it really works, and the pacing of it is absolutely incredible. It's pretty slow in parts, but that is definitely to its benefit. And I just have no idea where this series will go. And I am very excited about the 16 more hours of David Lynch that I have that will await all of us throughout this glorious summer.
That sounds great. I'm excited.
It's, yeah. Those are my 3 new movies. Quiet Passion, go see it. Twin Peaks, watch it. Covenant,
you probably. Just for Danny.
Yeah. Yeah, just only for Danny.
Dylan,
oh, Danny boy.
Dylan, you had a movie you wanted to talk about?
Yeah. I've been going through some 50s movies, and I fell into Letter Never Sent. It's the follow-up to The Cranes Are Flying, this Russian movie by Mikhail Kalatozov. And it follows geologists going to Siberia to look for diamonds for the glorious Mother Russia and the state. And it's hard for me to speak of the cinematography and the way those two movies are shot without being effusive, just because of how striking the images Kalatozov and Urusevsky get out of nature and cityscapes. But it makes you so happy. It's shot in black and white. The textures, it gets out of the forest, and just the heat behind it is beautiful. So it follows them searching for diamonds, and it kind of focuses, it's told, as the title implies, like epistemologically, like through a letter written by the main researcher, the man that brought them out there to find the diamonds, told as goes down writing the letter, towards the end. And it's specifically a major attention point is a love triangle that's created with two of the geology students he brings with him and a worker who's gone out to Siberia a whole bunch, so knows the lay of the land. And it kind of uses that attention point, that love triangle, as the base tension and rhythm and excitement and joy that kind of brings you into getting excited about hunting for the diamonds. And then it just, nature crashes in and messes everything up. And I don't know how in the world they filmed a forest being burned down, but it is the most unnerving thing I've seen in a while, just like being trapped in a forest fire. It is shot so well and so claustrophobic that it becomes a survival movie in a very real way. Kalatozov is kind of known for propaganda movies, and I think this one is the least of that. I mean, it's kind of the impetus is to getting the diamonds to raise the reputation of Russia and the state. But unlike Cranes Are Flying, which is definitely like a war movie and the people who are stuck at home during the war, and so it has a lot more wholesome state values or whatever. This one is definitely more personal and more terrifying in some way, because it is, a man versus nature movie or people versus nature movie. You may also know him from Soy Cuba. This is what he did. He went to Cuba to basically just do straight up a well-dressed propaganda movie. And I know that was used as like an influence for Boogie Nights, P.T. Anderson, whatever, said he got like straight up rip from that long, glorious tracking shot from Soy Cuba and used it. So if you're interested in striking images, this guy's movie is where it's at. So I'd highly recommend that. So
where did you watch this?
It's on Filmstruck, right? It's part of the Criterion really? Okay. collection and stuff. But I'm sure local library has it, mm-hmm. which was also an option for me. So it's really good.
Cool. Yeah. That sounds actually really interesting.
Tight 96 minutes. If that's even a more of a plus. Boom. So yeah, there you go.
It's even, that's a big plus there.
Yeah. It's an epic movie on a small scale. Look at that.
All right, real quickly, I wanted to talk about a pair of films really that I watched this weekend. The first one is a short film. It's like 20 minutes long. It is Street of Crocodiles by the Quay Brothers. It's a stop-motion animated short where this puppet that's newly released, kind of he just was released from his strings, explores this sinister room that he finds himself in, And it's funny, frequent contributor Jessica Carr texted me with a picture of the poster immediately after I logged it on Letterboxd and was like, this is terrifying. And I was like, yeah, this is a pretty I saw, like, sifting through Letterboxd reviews, people, you know, kind of, you know, referencing the Tim Burton. I don't know, this guy makes Tim Burton look like he's making stuff at, like, Toys R Us. Like, the Quay brothers are, like, a notch up. It's just this very grotesque, I think it's more in line with the strangeness of, like, the strain of the strings and the puppet and the material that you see in something like Coraline, where you have these long, you know, long needle fingers and everything seems a little bit off. I found a lot of that inspiration in Street of Crocodiles. I recommend watching it. It's on Fandor. It's a very strange little film, but I found it kind of endearing. The Coen brothers kind of had this, like, revival recently where Christopher Nolan, you know, brought a lot of their work into the forefront. So it's a good, but while watching it, it was very strange to I was trying to figure out why he would. It's a strange connection. The other film is much longer. It's about an hour and a half. It's almost an hour. And it's The Pied Piper. And it's a 1986 stop motion film directed by Jiri Barta. And it's this very dark retelling of The Pied Piper of Hamelin. It's very grotesque. It's very dark. It's a little bit. Even though it's only an hour, it's a little bit long. It probably should have been like 45, 50 minutes. But I just absolutely love the animation in this. It kind of calls back more to the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where you have those staircases in the kind of 2D form where, and you watch the characters and how they move up and down, and it feels more like you're kind of reading a storybook than anything else. And I just absolutely just love the vision of the film. It's just so bleak. It's so tragic. Barta just kind of really goes 100% into this story, and I don't know. It really worked for me as this kind of dark, you know, mysterious, fairy tale. Yeah, I this one is on Fandor as well. Like I said, it's about an hour. I recommend if you're into stop motion animation. I kind of got on this kick this weekend where I was watching a lot of what Fandor had to offer in animation. I also watched this like 6-minute film called Master of Ceremonies, where the skeleton dances around this house while it's burning down with this family inside and is like taking their possessions. And it's,
oh God.
it was a very dark, strange, like 10-minute long thing where I was just, it was very uncomfortable. But The Pied Piper, I think if you're a fan of stop motion animation and kind of watching how that form has progressed, this film really has the mark of, you know, the masters such as Ray Harryhausen and others, but, you know, that predate what we're, you know, more accustomed to with stop motion animation. And I always love to watch these kinds of films because it seems like they are I like the unabashed fascination into going, you know, deeper and darker and you know, it seems like a lot with a lot of animation that we have today, it's great, but there seems to be a safeness to it sometimes. And I've discovered with watching animation that, you know, is before like 1990, I like the daringness of it. So if you're into that, I would recommend watching The Pied Piper on Fandor. It's like I said, it's about an hour long. But yeah,
its own special commitment to get that dark with your puppets. So yeah, that sounds good. Really good.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back talking The Crowd after this.
Hello, Cinematary listeners. This is Andrew Swofford with an important message during this break in the show. Cinematary would like you to know that we do not want your money, and we don't want to place ads in the show at this time. That's not why we do this. We do it because we enjoy each other's company and because we want to bring you our pure, unadulterated opinions on the world of cinema. However, there are a few things you can do to help out the show that we would greatly appreciate. Firstly, leave us a review on iTunes, preferably a positive one, because the algorithm gods tell us that reviews increase our podcast exposure. Secondly, send us a tweet at Cinematary, or better yet, send an email to cinematary@yahoo.com so that we can hear from you guys for a change. Maybe you think I'm an idiot for not liking Singing in the Rain, or maybe you have a suggestion of a movie that you really want to hear our opinion on. Regardless, let us know your thoughts, and we'll read them out and respond to them on future episodes of Cinematary. Finally, please share the show with friends and members of your family who you think would enjoy listening to and participating in our film discussion we bring to you guys every week. So to recap, review, send us your thoughts through Twitter and email, and share with your friends and family. We would truly appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the show.
Two of episode 145 of Cinematary. In this part, we'll be starting our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1928's The Crowd. It was directed and written by King Vidor, with other script help from John V.A. Weaver, which I added just because I liked that name, and Joseph Farnham. The film follows the life of a man and woman together in a large, impersonal metropolis through their hopes, struggles, and downfalls. The Crowd was conceived by King Vidor and filmed after the success of his previous film, the critically acclaimed box office success, The Big Parade. Vidor wanted the new film to be innovative in its story, acting, and cinematography. The film mixes striking visual styles and moving camera cinematography, as well as hidden cameras in some of the New York scenes and subtle use of scale models and dissolves, which is influenced by 1920s German cinema and F.W. Murnau in particular, with intense, intimate scenes of the family struggle. Vidor avoided casting big-name stars in the film to attain greater authenticity. James Murray, James Murray? James Murray had started as a studio extra and had appeared in feature roles already, but had made his way to California riding boxcars and doing odd jobs such as shoveling coal and washing dishes. For his female lead, Vidor selected Eleanor Boardman, an MGM contract actress and also his second wife. Vidor's great financial success at MGM in the 1920s allowed him to sell the unusual scenario to production head Irving Thalberg as an experimental film. MGM chief Louis B. Mayer reportedly disliked the film for its bleak subject matter and a lack of a happy ending, and the studio held the film from release for almost a year. At the studio's insistence, seven alternate upbeat endings were filmed, according to Vidor's autobiography, and previewed in small towns. The film was finally released with two endings, one his Vidor's original ending, and another with the family gathered around a Christmas tree after John has gotten a job with an advertising agency. Exhibitors could choose which version of the show, but at least according to Vidor, the happy ending was rarely shown. One unhappy ending was to the life of James Murray, who succumbed to alcoholism and became a Skid Row bum. When Vidor saw him on the street panhandling, he offered Murray a part in his upcoming film, Our Daily Bread, which was actually used the characters from this movie. But Murray angrily refused, saying, quote, "Just because I stop you on the street and try to borrow a buck, you think you can tell me what to do? As far as I am concerned, you know what you can do with your lousy part." In 1936, his body was found in the... Yeah, That's true. In 1936, his body was found in the Hudson River, a possible suicide. Vito was haunted by Murray's death, and in 1979, attempted to raise funds to film The Actor, a screenplay he had written based on Murray's story, but the film was never made. Vidor, you know, he said this, you know, talking about the story for the crowd, quote, "I believe in subjective reality, that every man makes his own universe. By sharing his life and his emotions, you would then know that all others are more or less the same. Pick out one of the mob, one of the crowd, and follow him, and he'd go through the same emotions, the same experiences as other people." The crowd has been hailed as one of the greatest and most enduring American silent films. Director Jean-Luc Godard was asked in the 1960s why more films were not made about ordinary people, and his response was, quote, "The crowd has already been made, so why remake it?" But at the time, it was released just as the Great Depression had hit, and audiences sought escapist entertainment over the stark realism of the crowd, which filmmakers would not embrace again until after the end of World War II. Still, the film was popular enough to gross twice its cost. The arrival of sound films at the same time combined to radically change filmmaking. Due to the limitations imposed by early sound filming techniques, the crowd's moving camera innovations would not be equaled for another decade. The film earned 5 Oscar nominations at the very first Academy Awards, including Best Director and Best Unique and Artistic Production, which it lost to Sunrise by F.W. Murnau. We watched that last year. The New York Times called the crowd substantial and worthy and a powerful analysis of a young couple's struggle for existence in this city. Variety was not as hot. They said the film was, quote, "a drab, actionless story of ungodly length and apparently telling nothing." So they didn't like it. I guess to start out the discussion of the crowd, What kind of struck you most about this film? I was really taken with, I saw a lot of the stuff when I was researching was kind of commented on the universality of these characters. And, you know, I think that that's maybe a little, I think there's still some truth to that, but it maybe pushes, you know, the limits nowadays. But one of the things I really was taken by with the crowd was the way King Vidor would film these scenes of like these the big moments of these characters' lives, whether it's him proposing to marry his wife, his later wife, or the birth of their first child. They were never these intimate moments that were kind of close between these people. There was always kind of a largeness, a vastness, whether it was a big room or multiple, beds or multiple people or just crowds of people. I liked how he really hit that point of these, these kind of small people in this giant world, not with them kind of repeating over and over again that they were like that or people telling them that, but completely doing it cinematically and showing the vastness of New York City and kind of comparing them, in contrast to that. I mean, is that something that you guys picked up on?
Well, I was thinking that there was a tension in there, right? Because there was scenes of intimate home stuff, or even like smaller spaces that Vidor builds on the beach, and the tension comes when the outside comes into that, right? So, like with that beach scene specifically, Vidor likes the guy, the main character John Sims, he's just doing his thing, or whatever. In this case, playing the ukulele really loud. And just having a good time screaming about how he's all alone, even though he's with his family. And then a guy, a grumpy old man on the beach, says, "Hey, quit playing your zither," or whatever. I got that coming in one ear and the sand in another. And yeah, there's like a way, there's a way that tension between, your family and then the outside and the other people also living their own life, just slamming into one another. But there's also like really good intimate house moments, right? Like after they get married, and I think this was after the Christmas Eve scene with Mary's parents, and John gets really drunk and they reconcile or whatever at the end. But it's like the scene after that, it's April, and it's just a morning routine that small things like the bed not quite getting into its place right, and the cabinet opening and it's slamming into people. And it's just like small tension points like that that end up slowly boiling into an argument that I think was really effective. It almost feels like accidental in a way that was striking to me, that he was able to build those intimate moments out of small accidents that boil over.
Well, he was able to kind of like start it and then wrap it back around. Like they'd be angry at each other and they'd be angry, but they were able to kind of wrap it back around. I guess the point I was hitting at before is, for lack of a better term, it was like Vidor would take the quote Facebook moments, the moments, you know, where you'd post that like big light, you know, life moment, you know, that happens in your life, you know, that, you know, happens to you. He would take those moments and they would, you know, the characters, John and Mary, would still have them, but they were also juxtaposed with sure. just that it wasn't just about them. Yeah. It was just, there was just this vast sea of other people. And I just found that incredibly effective. But Nathan, what did you think?
I think that's good that you pointed out that, because that was one of the things I was going to kind of talk about in a little bit of a different way. But I felt like these characters, there was kind of a lack of interiority almost. I was reminded a lot, like it felt in some ways kind of like an urban version of Sunrise. Because the characters felt, I don't think maybe universal is the word I would use, but kind of more archetypal, where it's like, this is modern man, this is modern woman and wife and husband and worker. And like, they kind of are, I guess, supposed to be sort of representative of a couple in the city at that time. And it's like, you're following them throughout their life, but, like I definitely feel like I get a real sense of them as a person, but it's not like you're kind of sat down and told, here are all the things that happened in their lives, you know. I mean, you do get that bit at the beginning where you see John's childhood, but yeah, it's not like you don't learn all these kind of like little tidbits and factoids about them that make you feel like you really kind of know them, even though you're in these very personal moments in their space. I think, Zach, like you said, it's always kind of connected to this larger world, even in their most personal, intimate moments, which I guess is kind of just indicative of a lot of silent films, since you kind of have to like communicate characters through archetypes, you know, like you can't really there is no dialogue to like describe someone as a villain. So you have to give them a black hat and a crazy mustache to like let people know that's, you know, that's the bad guy. And where, while there's no necessarily like nothing like that obvious in this movie, I do think they kind of like Vidor kind of creates these archetypes of these societal roles, you know, husband, wife, employee, employer. Yeah,
but I think that's helpful. Just, you know, again, I think it's helpful to, you know, I guess to establish in so that that audience in 1928 can, you know, attach themselves to that, because they're going to see at least part of themselves in those characters. And so it kind of just goes back to the base reason of having archetypes. And so, that didn't bug me as much.
Oh, no.
You know, it kind of was, I guess that it was supposed to have this at least try to portray this all American family type vibe, to it.
Yeah. It didn't bother me at all either, because like, that's
the kind of the point.
I don't know. That's just it's just a different mode of filmmaking. It didn't bother me at all. It was just, something that I kind of noticed is that it was like, I don't know, there was always this kind of like, I feel like it was this sort of like, this movie is a very kind of modernist approach to a Hollywood narrative, because in some ways kind of reminded me of like of A Man with the Movie Camera, or Berlin, Symphony of a Metropolis, where you're like, you know, kind of always brought back to this larger world.
Yeah.
And you do have early in the movie all of the kind of skyscraper stuff, but so it's like always, And even in some of the kind of more jovial moments of the movie, like I think when John and his friend, what do you guys remember his friend's name?
Bert.
When they're going to pick up their dates and there's just this like revolving door of women. And it's just like everything is just on a timetable and really scheduled out. And like, you know, you really get the like kind of hustle and bustle, like this is the future, you know, everything is on a schedule, everything is really efficient, and these are just people who are just existing within this system. This is maybe a weird connection, but I've been making a video essay about it, and so it's been on my mind a lot, but it kind of like in some weird way reminds me of George Lucas's THX 1138, where you just got these like two people who happen to be in love with each other in this much larger, vaster structure. And, you know, they're just, you're constantly kind of like pulled back to that larger overworld view and reminded of that, even if you're getting these kind of personal moments at the same time.
Or, I mean, in that way too, that a lot of the tension in the movie comes from the outside, right? Like economic constraints, or in this case, they lose their daughter.
Oh God, that scene is just midway horrible.
God, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. I audibly said, oh my God, during that, like when I was watching that. Sorry. But.
Well, it happens in such like an up moment, yeah. Right? Like he gets the $500 for the pitch and the ad and it's all great. And then, you know, it's because they themselves like are all ecstatic and they have gifts for their kids and they go scream out the window, here, come get your gifts. And of course, and right at that moment, a car comes craning down, you know, can't be stopped the road and hits the daughter. Yeah, no, it's a crusher.
Hey, that's not a great word choice there.
apt. Nope.
There's just this constant, I think, kind of, it shows this sort of give and take life. You know, every time a good thing happens, a bad thing sort of happens, which I feel like this movie really believes in karma. I really love how at the end of the movie he ends up working as a clown.
God, that was
yeah,
rough.
He made fun of that other guy who he was like, oh, I bet his dad thought he was going to be president. And I'm like, I was just like, yeah. Gosh, that's like, your dad literally thought you were going to be president. And I really love. Yeah, I just love the connection back. I really like that.
Well, I one of the things I also loved is just how, again, going back to the point that Dylan and I were talking about earlier, is these more intimate kind of arguments that John and Mary would have. I think there was a little bit of a basicness and archetype to kind of the arguments that, you know, you need to get a job, or you need to, you know, we need to have
economic
this.
Arguments.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it was stuff that you could, that, you know, anybody would have. But again, I really liked how he was able to establish the argument. They kind of, he would allow it to go and go and go and reach its peak. And then he would work, like he would kind of work it back around. And I liked that because it gave it more of an authentic, you know, an authentic feel to a relationship. It felt less, you know, cinema-y, where it seemed like they had to get, you know, I felt like it was more genuine than it,
right,
than them kind of having to get back together for the sake of the movie. And I think that kind of goes back to Vidor, you know, his goal is, you know, of course the studio wanted all these alternate endings, but he kind of wanted one that felt true. And I kind of agreed with the direction he went. It felt true. And even though the ending shows them at this show laughing and everything, and I'm sure they get back together, but there's also there's still this ambiguity that he leaves you with. So even though you're gonna go, well, they're gonna get back together, he allows you this ambiguity to kind of say, well, yeah, but they still might not. And I think that kind of, that's more effective to me. And I really don't know, that's something that in terms of a relationship between the two lead characters in a movie that's, you know, so, you know, it's from 1928. I found that really groundbreaking. That was something that really struck me.
That archetypal doesn't have to mean is after he contemplates committing suicide and he has that special bonding moment with his kid, unconditional love. And so he decides to find a job and push through the crowd, or with the crowd, searching to find a job. And when he comes back, and it is clear that Mary is about to leave with her brothers to go live with them and probably take the kid with them, right? And there's like a way she hesitates, that he there's a plea in the room, but she's like, no, I'm really gonna leave. I'm sorry, this it's just too much. I know you have a job, but I can't believe you anymore, because you know the traumatic scenes all leading up to that he's really had a hard time living up to, you know, this ambition he has in his head. But so she leaves. She has this hesitating moment with her brother, saying he really needs me, blah blah blah, and she goes back in. But instead of saying, I'm going to stay, let me stay with you, I want to live with you, it's like, do you want to see your kid on weekdays or like every now and then, because I know that's important to you. It's not a this type of overwrought drama of her, accepting that dependency, that feeling that he needs her. And it's there's this human hesitation, right? There's this, they feel more like people or characters, fleshed out characters, than the archetype would belie, I guess.
No, I totally agree. One of the things I was thinking about while watching this is the long, like 45-minute sequence in Richard Linklater's Before Midnight, where the Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy character have this long, strained out argument, but it goes in so many different paths, and you can feel so many different emotions over the course of that 45 minutes that's what really sticks with you. And I felt like the crowd had a lot of moments where it was like that, where these actors, Eleanor Boardman and James Murray, they're able to convey the various emotions in the highs and lows, and they went so many different places in just one scene.
Yeah.
That I was just that was something that just incredibly, really impressed me, that a movie that was made this early was right. able to be able to do that.
One of the things that I like about this movie is it feels very humanist to me, and that you could make a pretty similar movie about probably any number of couples who are like in the buildings that you see, or in the city, or in the crowd.
Yeah.
That there's just that kind of like the way that he films it, and the structure of the movie, kind of having that cycle to it where he makes fun of the clown, and then at the end of the movie, he ends up as a clown. That gives it this kind of, narrative push. And
yeah.
And there's a lot of, I think you can really kind of see the debt to expressionism or something like that, because, I was really struck by the last shot in the childhood sequence where he's like coming up the stairs as his father has died. And it's just like, it's just this kind of like,
God.
It's mm-hmm. very symmetrical, but also really angular and kind of wonky at the same time, because it's like
it looks like stuff that Murnau has done, especially like, it's a vastly different film, but almost like Nosferatu, with how that character moves and glides. There's a glide to how he's moving toward the, up the stairs.
Yeah, it's like it's this kind of just perfect view. But at the same time, it's like when you're looking down a stairway, or you're looking down a hallway in quote unquote real life, like it's not going to look like that. And I really love how you kind of have this in the jaggedness, in the angles, you have this like literalization and physical manifestation of kind of his pain in that moment.
Almost a vertigo, right? Like it's flat, but it's trying to extend out. Ugh.
Totally. And so I like that there's that fusion of that really just stylized kind of nature and tendency. But it's fusing that with this sort of ordinary story where, like you've been saying, you have like real arguments grounded in the issues that couples face, grounded in finances and all these just kind of regular things that everybody is familiar with. So you have that perfect marriage, of a really distinct style, sense of style that is on one point removed from reality, but then you have kind of the narrative content and the real meat and marrow of the story itself is is grounded in things that are sort of identifiable and relatable.
So to extend out some of the things you're talking about too, in connecting these personal things, their personal story to the larger framework, that there a specific scene where he, John, it becomes a salesman, one of the odd jobs that he takes after he loses it from his daughter's death and gets reprimanded at his job, and he says, "I quit." And so he becomes like a vacuum salesman. And there's a way Vidor shoots him going to the next house where it's at like a really strong parallel line, whereas like all these houses that he's visited before that point, that it just points to what we've been talking about of this larger geometry, this larger structure that that the same couples found themselves in, but that also hints at that his story is potentially other people's story as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That larger geometrical connection and composition even like heightens it or brings it back. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what really stuck with me, at least in terms of how Vidor shot it, is he would show this giant geometry. The one example I have is when his first child is born and he opens the door at the hospital to the ward where Mary is, and the room is a lot bigger than you like thought, just from judging from the from the doorway, and it's just this big room and there's beds everywhere, he's kind of just like looking for, he's in there and it's this big moment in his life and he's going, where's my wife? Where's my wife? And they're just like, "I don't know." And you look at the waiting room like 30 other guys, 30 other men right. waiting for their kids. And so it's like, it just takes the kind of spark out of it that it's like, yeah, this guy's the star of the movie, but there's other people having babies this day. It's not that, it's not that big of a deal, but I liked how he would shoot that, that fastness. There's the sequence when John is coming to New York City and they have the title card that's like, he's joining the sea of 1.7 million others who are trying to do this as well. And it has like the kind of, shot of like Manhattan, and then it goes, it does a dissolve and it shows all the people moving around. There's another dissolve and there's like more people moving around, and it has that crazy pan up the skyscraper, and I just love the cinematic qualities of that, because Vidor immediately in that moment, it shows you, without having to show you too much, just from those four cuts of, he's showing you the 1.7 million people. They almost didn't need that title card. That seemed to almost be a little bit of an overkill.
Something about the values of that movie, just real quick, I worry about it. It does feel like particularly American values too, because it is set in such the metropolis of New York. But when it says, I think the inner title is like, "He became one of the 7 million that believe New York depends on them." There is like such a sad cynicism to that of course it depends on them. Just because you're in that larger structure doesn't mean that you're not a part of it. You know what I mean? Like, there's a potential way to be. I mean, it's really good and dramatic to have like the crowd as like this really bleak, terrifying metaphorical structure. But even as much as I like this movie, it made me really sad thinking that was just kind of it, and then there was just like, I don't know, the willingness to not have more of these people come together like. The family as such an isolated unit of people that they can't actually connect across to other families, it felt like. And I don't know.
Yeah. Especially like in that sequence after his daughter has died, and he's like running through the streets, and they're just, the police officer who's just like, "Sir, you're not the, pretty much this, you're not the only person who has an issue going on right now."
That seemed to be helping.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other thing, is the crowd is when they're bringing the girl into the house and the crowd's like following, like it's just so
into their own apartment.
Well, that's what I was just immediately think as I was just like, I was like, man, King Vidor, he's already predicting like Facebook Live and Periscope and the invasiveness of people into people's lives.
Well, it's like
I had a brief moment with that.
I thought that that title card you mentioned about, you know, all the people thinking that the city depends on them. I don't know. I thought that was kind of funny. Just because, I don't know, thinking about, like, I mean, like, I'm about to move to New York, so, like, what can I say? But I feel like every time you see, you know somebody or you see somebody who's moving to New York, there's, like, this big to-do about it, even if there is, they're only kind of living sort of an ordinary, regular life and not doing anything crazy, spectacular, or noteworthy. They're like, oh, you know, I'm moving to New York. It's like, that's, this is my city now, even though there are all these other people. It's like, I'm from New York, and there's this kind of real, just like people, I don't know, kind of act like they own it all. And it's, there's a kind of a back and forth in the movie between, I feel like, condemnation of the crowd. You know, I'm thinking of like that early moment where John is getting off work and he's washing his hands and everybody who comes by says some like very quaint, like old buddy, old pal, kind of like, oh, you're scrubbing your paws, John, or like, you know, you're activating the suds or like whatever. I thought that was really funny. But then he's, you know, he says like, oh, you guys worked in the same place so long, you know, you're all the same. So it's like, on one hand, I feel like in that moment, you know, and then in kind of the other moments of that repetition and that really just kind of regimented acting, King Vidor is kind of commenting on the crowd and how, you know, everyone kind of conforms into this mess. But then it's like that scene on the bus where John is like above the crowd and he's pointing out at everyone and mocking them. And it's like in that moment, I was like, I hate you so much.
Come on,
you're
John.
Like, what? You know, what makes you so special? Like, we've seen all these moments where you are in the crowd. You know, you work in this building where kind of all the desks are the same and everyone is the same. And so now that you have this moment where you're above instead of the spectator of the film, you know, you're immediately passing judgment on all these people. So it's like there, I think there's that kind of, this is the kind of back and forth.
What was that turn of phrase that Bert, giving him the hi-hat or something like that? Who are you with the hi-hat?
Yeah.
What the hell?
And I honestly, throughout the movie, I really I did not like John a lot of the time, but I really liked kind of the perspective, that was given, to his wife, because, you know, like there's that scene where they go on vacation and, she's, you know, cooking and like having to do all the things that she does at home. And she's like, vacation, my eye. You know, I'm still, she says, like, I'm doing the same things that I do every day.
I'm still doing the same thing.
So I was like, that's, I think, like, that's a really valuable insight. Even if you know, John is, for all intents and purposes, kind of the main character,
she's very important as well.
And like, it gives really valuable insight into the situation, I think, of wives and of women, in the domestic sphere.
I want to add to that scene. There's also the line that she has where, John says something about, you know, it'll be better when I'm, you know, when I'm on top, or, you know, whenever I get a promotion, or
when
my ship comes in, she's like, yeah, well, you know, would your ship get lost or something? Like, she makes this really snide remark. And I like that. I was like, it was a really, I just like that moment where she's like, oh yeah. Like, she's been hearing this over and over again. She's just finally like, when's that damn ship going to come in, John?
I was very stressed out when they close up of the cake and the sun just constantly jumping over the cake. I was like, for God's sake, please, you can run anywhere else on the beach. Why do you have to hop over the cake? But
All right. I guess to wrap up, I guess for people who are wanting to watch The Crowd, I think all three of us, that you can stream it on the internet. There's various ways it's kind of poking into places, but it's kind of curious. Dylan and I were talking about last night when we were both going to get ready to watch it. But there, I guess a lot of places it has it like a little bit longer, like 98 minutes. But the version I watched was like an hour and 25 minutes. It was a lot. Yeah. It was shorter. So I'm curious. Yeah. I wonder if that's also, just thinking about the notes also, I wonder if that different, like the endings makes it kind of, you know.
Oh yeah, maybe.
You know, maybe it's one of the endings is, you know, like, you know, you have the one where they're gathered around the Christmas tree after he's gotten a job, which sounds awful. That would be just, that would completely take the punch out of that movie.
Yeah.
That sounds more like a Frank Capra movie. But
I mean, if the version we watched felt really breezy and
yeah,
tightly contained. So it didn't feel like we really missed out much. So unless, right, they extended the Coney Island date scene even longer, or they goes on a longer walk at some point, I don't know what we missed. Or like the job scene where he's hunting for a job, unless it kept bouncing him around. I don't know where that 8 minutes or so went.
Yeah, it's just something curious I'd like to figure out. But yeah, I wonder if that's one of the, is maybe they're basing it off one of the other endings that, you know, maybe the, one of the other, you know, one of those seven alternate endings that they had that was filmed.
So it's like the note that they put up is the longest version, even if it's not the one you watch. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that'll wrap up this episode. You can find Cinematary on social media at Facebook at facebook.com/groups/cinematary, on Twitter at @Cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary. We'll repost all of the movies that we talked about in this episode. Next week, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1929's Pandora's Box.
Sexuality out of control, the movie.
All right. I'm excited about this one. Well, I know, Dylan, you've talked about this previously on the podcast, correct?
Yeah, I remember bringing it up. Yeah, when I was going through a 20s Jagger. Yeah, watching more. Yeah, the 20s German stuff, right? So Murnau, and I think that's G Pabst or whatever it is. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm excited to watch, because I think I remember when you talked about it, I had put it on my watch list, but I guess now I'm officially getting to it, because I have to, because I have to talk about it.
Right. Yeah. It's Weimar Republic or whatever, right before the economic collapse, and people are hooting and hollering, and it's good. Oh, yeah.
All right. But thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next week.